And welcome to another edition of Green Zine here at Free Vermont Radio, Royalton Community Radio, WFVRLP in South Royalton, Vermont. Todd in the studio, Henry on the phone line from the Queen City of Burlington, Vermont. And we have a jam-packed show. We're going to start off with some very interesting music sent over by our good friends and underwriters of the radio station at Bale. But before we get to that, let's remind you that underwriters, members, listeners keep, and all our volunteer staff keep this radio station going each and every day for more than 12 years. We do want to thank Solaflect, also Bale, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, who are going to be helping out on the green, the South Royalton Market, having their annual meeting and also a celebration of music out there this Saturday. First Branch Coffee Company is going to be at the event as well. Solar Fest is coming up pretty soon. We'll give you the dates, August 8th, 9th, and 10th over in Brandon, Vermont. Also, Wit and Grit Restaurant in Randolph, Vermont, and the Yes We Can Collective. But let's start with a little bit of music, and then I'll bring Henry into the mix here. Green Zine. What do you think of that, Henry?
That's lovely.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks to the folks at Bale. It's called Spell Songs. I can send you a link to it. Spell Songs, The Lost Words Blessing. There were two or three very understated, well, the piano was clear, but a couple of string players that were kind of in the undercurrent and three different female vocalists. The Spell Songs, The Lost Words Blessings, out on Hudson Records if you're going to try to find that. Yep. Get a start. Yeah. Yeah, be careful as you walk out into the wild. Really like the message of that.
Yes. Do they have other songs, other things?
I haven't gotten that deep into it. I know when I received this from, I think Elena over at Bale sent it to me, or Chris Wood, I listened to it and said, wow, I can tell why they're sending me this piece of music. I didn't follow up on it, but I did mark it with Green Zine so that each week before we go on the air, Henry, I actually go look at anything that I've tagged with Green Zine because the intent is possibly to use it on the next show, and that one's certainly qualified. Yep.
Yes. Nice.
So here we are.
Right.
Very good. Let's carry on.
Yes, well, if I had known that was the one, I might have chosen a different bird note. But
yeah, two or three different birds. Larks mentioned in there, ravens, and maybe there were one or two other ones in there as well.
Yeah.
But you did choose bird note. I'm glad that you did. We like presenting that each week. I'm going to bring that tab up. But our feature today, though, let's talk about that.
Yeah, okay. So I've borrowed a long time ago, but it's only recently been available, a book, an audio book. I'm listening to it as an audio book. And it's What If We Get It Right? And so it's all about climate change and the opportunities for doing it right and how that's structurally a good thing, as well as just sort of warding off calamity, and so I'm within this. One of the chapters is an interview with Bill McKibben, And we're going to listen to two excerpts from that chapter. That chapter is, the book is about 27 hours long on audio.
Oh, is it really?
And so this chapter is a 53-minute chapter, and we're going to listen to about 25 minutes of that in two pieces.
Right.
So
while still on that, I just want to properly acknowledge, this is a book that actually my partner and I purchased when we were in Maine, and we heard the author of this book give a presentation at a library up there in Blue Hill, Maine. Her name is Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. She is an environmentalist primarily with ocean systems, and I believe she's employed either at the University of Maine at Orono or possibly at Bowdoin College, but one of the colleges in Maine. And the complete title of the book that this excerpt that you have is What If We Get It Right? Visions of Climate Futures. A very impressive speaker, and looking forward to the interview. Yeah,
she's really got her. She's got it together, and she has interviewed. And we might play some of that interview. She's interviewed a guest we've had on Green Zine, talking about natural systems and what they can do for us.
I came across a lot of different names that were familiar to me. And then I liked how she had the little snippets about kind of when things go wrong, kind of like a bullet point list almost at the end of every other chapter. So little factoids.
She has extraordinary data points that she interjects through the book.
Yep.
And I have put up, or will be putting up on Green Zine Links, a reference to that book. And in that reference, there is also a video interview that you can click on and listen to, because her book was done before the election, before Trump was elected. but only in the, it was September of 24. So, so some of the things in the book are overly optimistic because they think that the Biden activity is going to continue.
Uh-huh.
And but there's certainly great information without that, without the downside of a lot of that being clawed back. There's still really good stuff. So,
and we, as a program, we're going to, we won't be overly optimistic, but we will try to continue to have at least a few notes of optimism in each episode of Green Zine, along with the gloom and doom. Yeah.
This one has got some.
All right. I'm looking at a very attractive bird here, Henry.
Yes. So it's time to move on to birds with crests, birds with like blue jays, and that's where they start. And but it turns out for all kinds of birds, we have tufted titmice here that have a crest, and we have
cardinals,
yes. And there is yet another one I'm thinking of that I have spaced. Anyway, it'll come to me. But there are multiple. Anyway, so we'll listen to Bird Note because it's all about birds and their crests.
All right, here we go. Let's roll a Bird Note. You're listening to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio.
This is Bird Note. A rakish, eye-catching crest really sets some birds apart. Picture the blue jays of the east, or Steller's jays of the west. A jay's crest is made up of a slender array of feathers on top of its head. These feathers are a bit longer and can be spiked up or slicked back, depending on what the bird is trying to communicate. When jays are sitting on eggs, feeding their young, or hanging out with their mate, their crests lie low. But in the case of heightened arousal, like in courtship or conflict, a jay's sharply raised crest tells a tale. The same goes for northern cardinals, and perhaps most crested birds. Even birds without crests, like crows or sparrows, sometimes puff up their short crown feathers. Why some species have crests and others don't remains a complex evolutionary question dating back to the dinosaurs. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Well, thank you, Michael, and thank you, Henry. Now I'm going to keep an eye out. I just heard some blue jays the other day, and I'm going to be watching for that crest to see if they're being mellow or they're getting fired up.
So we have chickadees come to our bird feeder quite frequently, and I see even chickadees fluffing up their head feathers sometimes. So I guess we'll have to dig into the dinosaur past to understand. But I think it's all about presentation. They're staking out their territory or being mellow, and so it's a facial expression for birds.
There you go. Well, good information. Hey, we're going to get shortly here in the next few minutes. We'll get to the first lengthy part of Ayanna Johnson's interview with Bill McKibben. But this is front page news, and I'm glad that the reporter, Darren Marcy from The Herald, must have been attending the recent Tunbridge Select Board meeting by way of Zoom, because that was on Tuesday night, and yet this story did make the paper here by last night when it went to print and is out on the streets today. So for local folks who have been following the saga of the Tunbridge Legal Trails and a lawsuit that came about partway through this nearly five-year saga, here's the headline, and then I'm going to read from the opinion. Judge sides with town. That would be the town of Tunbridge in In the Trails case, landowners promise appeal to Supreme Court, which is no surprise. So in a sense, the epilogue is coming. Most of the chapters may be behind us. Legislation has been passed and signed by the governor clarifying this. But I'm going to go to the final part of this story. This is Judge Dixon Corbett, who's been holding off on this case till he got a response from both the plaintiff and the defendant on whether they wanted to pursue summary judgment. Both parties said yes. So in the end, in his ruling, the court's final observation is that real life experience has been that Vermont towns are maintaining their trails. More than 150 towns have at least one trail, and there are more than 540 miles of public trails in the state. And while at least some private landowners are helping maintain public trails, many towns are maintaining their trails to keep them open for public use. In other words, widespread and contemporaneous interpretation has been that towns have the authority to maintain and repair their public trails. A reading of the statutes that authorizes towns to maintain and repair their public trails would be consistent with more than a century of both legal precedent and practical experience. Those are the words of Judge Dixon Corbett.
So where is Judge Corbett?
Well, he was, he started off as being an assistant state's attorney, and then he might have become the state's attorney for Orange County, but he now presides in the Windsor County as part of a district court. So he's down in Woodstock. That's where he is. The early part of this case was up at the Chelsea Courthouse. I've been there for that part, and I was at the Supreme Court when they made their first ruling on the issue of ripeness. Darren Marcy kind of lays out a pretty good scenario of how this case has come to this point. Trails are open, so it is a public right-of-way. So folks that like to get out in nature and a little bit of history of their individual towns, get out and responsibly use the legal trails.
Well, that's something, and this will hasn't yet to go to the Supreme Court of the state of Vermont, but it'll be clarification of something that has been a little bit in the gray area for many, many years.
Yeah, and actually at the select board meeting, and this is not in the story, it seems like there's a consensus that this judgment and also the attorney's advice for the town is that continue on, even if there is an appeal, you should continue if you wanted to go ahead and do maintenance or not. Don't allow the appeal, which of course will take quite a while if it ever does reach the Supreme Court. With the legislation being passed and becoming fully effective on April 1st of 2026, I'm going to put my semi-lawyer hat on. I have a feeling that the Supreme Court may decline the appeal. That would be a best case scenario for just backing up the judgment from Judge Corbett.
Yeah. So it's pretty amazing. The wheels of justice grind fine, but grind slowly.
Yeah, they do tend to grind pretty slowly as someone who was there at the very beginning almost 5 years ago. Hey, so I do have the interview. Anything else before we want to jump in here with Ayanna and Bill? We're on a first name basis with these folks.
Yes, I feel that way. No, I think we should listen to this, and then we'll have a little break, and I'll give you kind of set you up for the second piece I took out of here. They're both of them from the same chapter.
Okay, let's take a listen here to Ayanna. Elizabeth Johnson, I think that's her full name, and Bill McKibben in this interview segment, thanks to Henry from the Book on Tape.
Divest and Protest. Interview with Bill McKibben. I first met writer and activist Bill McKibben in 2000 when I was a junior in college. Bill came to Harvard to teach a seminar with Professor James McCarthy, an oceanographer and lead author of the third assessment report of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC. The class textbook was a huge three-ring binder filled with a rough draft of that hundreds of pages long report, A Global Consensus on Climate Science. Reading through that report, let's be honest, I was mostly skimming. While I got the general point, the Earth is warming with awful knock-on effects, the gravity of it didn't sink in. From projected sea level rise to the hundreds of millions of people who could be displaced, it all seemed abstract to me. Footnote: sea level rise is now expected to displace between 250 and 400 million people globally by 2100. I took that class more than 20 years ago, when climate change seemed abstract to most people, if they thought about it at all. But it was certainly already concrete for Bill, who in 1989 published The End of Nature, the first popular press book on climate change. When Bill reminisced with me about writing that first book, he shared that in his naivete, he'd believed that once the scientific evidence was presented, the world leaders would respond with decisive action to the greatest danger humanity had ever faced. He says now, quote, "But by the UN climate negotiations in Kyoto in 1997, it was clear that the fossil fuel industry had mobilized to fight against this scientific reality and its implications, and they were having real success. So by that point, I was getting pretty scared," end quote. Bill has been turning reasonable fear into smart climate action from the beginning of this movement. He's an esteemed leader, collaborator, chronicler, and elder to myself and thousands of others. He's a phenomenally prolific journalist who has published 20 books and hundreds of articles, and now shares weekly dispatches in an influential climate newsletter. He co-founded, in 2008 with some of his Middlebury College students, the now global grassroots climate activism group, 350.org. From fights against oil and gas pipelines to campaigns to get university and pension funds to divest from fossil fuels, he's been helping to lead the way. Recently, Bill's work has been focusing on something perhaps even more fundamental than fossil fuel corporations, the banks that finance them. In the last few years, your activism and your writing have really shifted to focus on the money, right? Who's funding all of this creation of more fossil fuel infrastructure? Who are the banks that are financing this stuff? Because obviously, these fossil fuel companies need outside investment to make all this happen. So I'm curious, was there a moment when you realized this wasn't so much about Exxon per se as it was about Wall Street?
Sure. So part of that's been through the lens of this divestment campaign that we got going, which when we started it, you know, we had no real idea. It was really Naomi Klein and I kind of dreamt up some of it. And, we did not know that it would grow to where it has. It's now arguably, I think, the biggest anti-corporate campaign in history. We're at about $40 trillion in endowments and portfolios that have divested, including lots of pension funds and things, but also, as you point out, lots of educational institutions, you know, Oxford and Cambridge and Harvard and Princeton and the University of California and on and on and on down a very long list. So that, I think, got me started sort of thinking, understanding that there are two levers in this climate fight big enough to be worth pulling. One of them's marked politics, and we've tugged hard on that one, and finally it's open to one degree or another. And people have done remarkable work over the last few years in making that happen. Above all, the Sunrise Movement and Varshini Prakash and so many others who really were the most successful political organizers around climate that there have been. The other door that's big enough to make a difference, that enough power resides behind, is marked money or finance. And we now understand, I think, just how important it is.
And the number that stuck out to me that you use as part of this Banking on Our Future campaign is that, you know, these handful of large banks have loaned out over $3 trillion to fossil fuel companies to expand their extraction. In the years since, countries around the world signed the Paris Climate Agreement.
That's right. And those four American banks in the U.S., Chase, Citi, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, are also the four biggest lenders to the fossil fuel industry. They've lent more than $1 trillion of that. They're by far the biggest lenders to the fossil fuel industry. That money, as it's, you know, used for pipelines and things, produces extraordinary clouds of carbon.
Footnote, per the Carbon Bankroll report, quote, if the largest banks and asset managers in the U.S. were a country, they would be the third largest emitting country in the world, behind China and the U.S., end quote. J.P. Morgan Chase alone lent $434 billion to the fossil fuel industry from 2017 to 2022.
We finally have, thanks to Bank Forward and some other groups this year, a really detailed study of just how much. And the numbers are incredible. I wrote about it for The New Yorker when it first came out, and they looked at the financial holdings of the big tech companies, Google, you know, so on, because A, these guys have a lot of money, and B, because they're all pledged to go net zero. Well, it turns out that the money they have sitting in the bank is producing far more carbon than anything they're doing with their operations. When they factored in these new numbers, Google's carbon emissions went up 111% overnight. Microsoft's were up even more than that. You know, Netflix, more carbon coming from its cash than from all the servers around the world dishing out bad TV every night, night after night after night. The numbers, when they get applied to individual people, are really remarkable. If you have $125,000 in the bank, and a lot of people my age with their retirement savings and things do have $125,000 in the bank, that's producing more carbon than all the flying, cooking, heating, cooling, driving that the average American does in a year.
Yeah, because it's potentially funding the expansion of fossil fuel extraction.
Turned over to people to go frack with, you know. Almost certainly, though we don't have the final numbers yet, but almost certainly, a city like, say, New York City, because it has lots of money in the bank, it's always collecting taxes and things like that, that money is producing more carbon than all the subway trains and police cars and fire trucks and school buses and whatever else New York City runs in the course of a day.
Footnote, good news. New York City is committed to achieving net zero greenhouse gas emissions in its public pension funds by 2040, one of the first cities in the nation to make this commitment, due to the activism of 350 NYC and others.
So getting a handle on this is incredibly important, and it should not be an impossible task. Like, fighting Exxon is really key, and we've done it, you know, with some success, but we're well aware that Exxon is going to fight to the last breath. You know, their business model depends entirely on digging stuff up and setting it on fire. They don't know how to do anything else, and so they'll fight to the end. But there's no reason for Chase or Citi to fight to the end. They make some money, you know, off this part of their deal book, but it's like 5-7% of their business. It's a declining part of their business because clearly renewable energy is going to be more important in the years ahead. So the hope is, one of the reasons that they started with these big tech companies like Google or Apple or whatever and demonstrated just what a huge amount of carbon they were producing with their cash is because we're hopeful that we can enlist those guys in this fight, you know? It'd be really good if Tim Cook sat down with the dude who runs Chase and said, look, nice to see you as always. We can't meet our net zero promises because you guys keep taking our money and handing it over to Exxon. So you're going to have to choose Apple or Exxon. Which do you want?
Mm-hmm.
When that happens, I think they'll make the right choice. In the meantime, to help speed up that day, we have a vast, big consumer campaign going on against these banks.
And this is your new work with Third Act, the organization you helped create. And there's this campaign around banking. And I think the thing that I find so exciting about Third Act is that you are specifically aiming to engage an older audience, right?
That's
you're,
right.
You're thinking about people who are in their third act of life, people who
That's
are
right.
probably retired in their 60s or 70s or 80s and wanting to make sure that they do their part to leave behind a habitable planet.
Beautifully put. We've been going almost a year now, and we've got tens of thousands of volunteers across the country and working groups in many, many states and cities and so on. And one of the projects we're working on is this campaign around banking. And now, happily, lots and lots of other groups have joined in. The Sierra Club, the Stop the Money Pipeline Coalition, Hip Hop Caucus, on and on. And the only thing we're asking of them, and this is what makes it so preposterously easy, is to stop funding the expansion of fossil fuels. Everyone's well aware that we're going to be using oil, sadly, for a few more years. Oil, sadly, for a few more years, because the oil industry has spent 30 years making sure that that's the case, blocking earlier action. And so they'll need a bank, just like anybody needs a bank, to keep on carrying on daily business. Fine. What's not fine is financing any more expansion of this infrastructure. Well, the banks are saying they're not even going to come up with their net zero policies, whatever they're going to be, until 2027. I mean, come on. We got to work a little harder than this because we're actually in an incredible emergency. The International Energy Agency, which is not exactly a radical outfit, Henry Kissinger founded it in the 1970s as a club of the big oil-consuming countries, said that if we had any hope of meeting the targets we'd set in Paris, investment in new oil and gas fields and infrastructure had to stop in 2021, period. That did not faze the big banks a bit. They've continued to lend hundreds of billions of dollars a year for just those purposes. It's as if they just cannot stop themselves, that their pursuit of very short-term profit, well, that they just can't rein themselves in. So we're going to try to rein them in. And it's not an impossible task to imagine that.
What does it actually look like if we get it right? Can you paint us a picture of what the scenario would be, what the world would look like if we managed to rewire the finance system so that it's helping to create a climate future that's safe?
So first of all, let's just get clear on the massive scale that we're talking about. The UN estimates that the world needs about $2 trillion a year in new investment, most of it in the global south, in order to build out renewable energy at the pace that we need to build it out. So that's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money.
The good news is there is a lot of money
yes.
in the world. The bad news is that it's all in the global north. If you want to think about it in the biggest terms, that's money that fossil fuel produced over the last 200 or 300 years as the North got rich off the burning of fossil fuel. And remember, we burned all the fossil fuel. I mean, the entire continent of Africa has produced something like 2 or 3% of all the global carbon emissions. For all intents and purposes, a rounding error in the calculations. The United States alone has produced about 25% of the carbon in the air.
The most of any nation on the world, all told.
By far. No one will ever catch us, not even China. And it's all still up there. You know, all the carbon I poured into the air when I got my learner's permit when I was, you know, 15 back in the 1970s. That's all still up there trapping heat. We got rich. We got immense amount of money, hundreds of trillions of dollars, most of it in the form, or a lot of it in the form of pension funds and retirement savings. The best chance of mobilizing that trillions is for it to be seen as a good investment. So, you know, realistically and in some ways rightly, people who have a pension that they spent their lives working for, want and need that money to be invested in something that will give them a decent return. That's what, how they're planning to live out their retirement. Renewable energy in Africa or South America or Asia should provide a reasonable return. It's pretty cheap to put up, and, you know, so people will be able to afford to pay for it, and that money will provide a return.
Yeah, and if people over in the Global South can get loans at a reasonable rate, then they can afford to install a lot of this renewable energy much more quickly.
So the catch here is at a reasonable rate. So at the moment, if you're in, I don't know, Nigeria or Ghana or Cote d'Ivoire or someplace, it's expensive to access money for these kind of things from the north.
Yeah, because people think it's a risky investment.
People think it's risky. And in some ways, it may be risky. So they demand a lot of interest for the privilege. You know, they'll lend you money, but it's going to cost you 15 or 20%, which is too much. It makes it unrealistic to do these projects. So the idea that's emerging is that the what we call the multilateral development banks, the MDBs, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, will figure out how to take a small amount of public money and sort of sprinkle it into the middle of these deals to take away most of the risk. And that would then allow this vast amount of money in the global north to be used for these vital projects. Now, look, I'm not saying that this is the most enlightened possible outcome here. It really isn't. But in realistic terms, it's at least part of the answer that we're going to have to get at.
These are the structures that we already have that are moving huge amounts of money from the global north to the global south, often with some dangerous strings attached.
That's right. They're moving some amounts of money, but not huge amounts. So what we need them to do is to use their financial acumen to de-risk those investments so that the truly vast sums in those pension funds and things can make that journey north to south. Because most of the money is in private hands. And I do not foresee a moment when we just decide to act as charitably as we should, as morality requires. Justice works through politics, you know? And that's a sad truth, but there you are.
That's a really hard truth to stomach, yeah.
Yeah. So figuring out how to do it in a way that is as fair and helpful as possible to the Global South is probably going to be the main work of these sort of ongoing UN negotiations and things over the next few years. My guess is that most of the focus that's left in the kind of global diplomatic process is going to be around these questions of finance. So in the largest sense, we have to take some of that money, that wealth that fossil fuel created, and figure out how to put it to work in the places that fossil fuel decimated. And that's the challenge. Some kind of at least beginning of rebalancing on this planet. There's other rebalancings that are going to have to go on. I mean, the most fraught and most important in some ways is the fact that we've literally made it impossible for people to live in parts of the global south, and that territory will keep expanding over the decades to come.
And in terms of heat, like temperatures that are too hot for human physiology to even handle, and
too hot,
the flooding,
too dry,
and the sea level rise, and
that's right, the ocean is suddenly in your living
failures.
Room,
yeah.
On and on and on. Well, you know, we're going to have to figure out how to let people in those places, some of them, come live in these places, because that's the only possible thing that'll work. And truthfully, that'll end up helping the global north too, because, you know, we're aging, tiring populations. So there are going to be some rebalancing in terms of population too, one hopes, over the next decades. But that rebalancing away from the incredibly inequitable world we inhabit now, it has got to be the work of this century, both for moral reasons and for very practical ones, because we cannot solve these problems otherwise.
Hmm.
Okay, Henry, that's the end of the first excerpt. Wow, justice through politics. That's, kind of a long, strange trip.
Yes, a lot of strange ideas in there, really. They go on to wiggle their way through in this chapter through many different concepts. But there is a book that they are both have read and are aware of and comment on, and it's Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson's book Abundance, and the concept here is that right now we're living in an economy that is constrained by scarcity. So the oil companies in the United States, when they first had oil bubbling out of the ground in Pennsylvania, everyone went out and drilled holes, and they produced oil and gasoline, and it was overabundant, and consequently, it didn't work as a business, and all these small companies that did their drilling and were in the extraction business and trying to sell it were competing with one another, and it kept going below cost of production, and the companies would go bust. And so the big oil companies got together, formed a cartel, and said, we're going to limit supply so that we can set our prices. And that's what the oil Arab oil embargo did, was limit supply in order to hold the price at a level that was made good profit for the people drilling and doing that. And then there's the concept of, okay, so that's capitalism forcing a pinch in the pipeline, no pun intended, in order to get a higher price. And certainly the drug companies are doing that in the United States. They aren't charging us the price it costs them to investigate and produce it. They're doing it with a nice big profit margin involved. And so if we look at things that are abundant, when you have solar panels generating free electricity once the solar panels are up, that's abundance. There's no longer a choke point. When you have natural systems, you have, instead of putting chemical fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides on fields in order to maximize crop production, you're destroying the soils and the ability to produce that. And the amount of those additives have to go up and up to get the same crop yields. So if you go to a system that's nature-driven and that does it on its own, that's a form of abundance. And so with that in that kind of background in mind, here's the next little section that that is in their interview.
Yeah, so we're going to return to the conversation between Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, the author of the book that this excerpt is taken from, as she interviews Bill McKibben, of course, a fellow Vermonter, lives over in Ripton.
Okay, Bill, so I really want to lean into this question of your vision for the future if we get it right. So a quote from you that stuck out to me in some of your recent writing was, you wrote, put simply, at the moment, the easy supply of money from the banking system to big oil drives the ongoing climate crisis. Capitalism is straight up behaving like a suicide machine. So what would it look like if we rewired this suicide machine to actually be part of the process of healing ecosystems and supporting life?
Well, let's just start with getting them out of the business of wrecking the planet first, okay? Because trajectory is everything. I don't know where we're going to end up exactly, but we need to be on something like the right trajectory. We got pretty good news in mid-December when, after impeccable work by activists in the UK, HSBC, the biggest bank in Europe, announced that indeed it was going to stop lending money for the development of new oil and gas fields.
Yeah, that was really big news.
Very big news. For a couple of reasons. Let me say, it's not everything they should be doing. They'll still be lending money for some kinds of fossil fuel infrastructure and things. But it's a big deal because they're one of the biggest bank in Europe, 13th biggest in the world in assets. They have $4 trillion in assets, and they've been a massive lender to the tune of more than $100 billion to the oil and gas industry. So when Citi and Chase and Wells Fargo and Bank of America look around now, a lot of their cover is gone. One of the big boys, one of the players in their club, has ceded to reason, has heeded physics, and they did not want to give up this part of their business, but they eventually figured out that they better do it or else there was more trouble ahead for them. And that's always the job of activists, it seems, with corporations, to make it more painful to keep doing the wrong thing than to do the right thing. So job one is to stop that. And once that bleeding is stopped, then, yes, there's a different vision of what finance might look like going forward. Hopefully, it'll start to be, as with energy production, more decentralized and local. At the moment, most American assets end up in these huge money center banks where they're just used for this endless casino of speculation and funding one dismal thing after another. But instead, it's possible to imagine a financial ecosystem that's much more reliant on things like local credit unions, local state and municipally owned banks like the one in North Dakota, that lend out money for local projects to local people and keep more money closer to home. In general, that should be happening as we start to rely more and more on renewable energy because, you know, oil and gas are in Texas and Saudi Arabia and Russia, but sun and wind, happily, are everywhere.
That's a really interesting thing to point out. I hadn't thought about it that way before, that sort of by the very nature of renewable technologies, they are and can be and should be more distributed, which means that the financing and maintaining and job creation can be distributed more broadly as well.
Absolutely. If you rely on any resource, but in this case, energy, that you can only find in a few deposits around the world, the people who control those deposits end up with too much power. And conversely, if you rely on something that's available everywhere, it helps walk us down this ladder of centralization back towards something that probably will work somewhat better than the thing we've got going now, because your local credit union is less likely to behave like the suicide machine that Chase or Citi are behaving like at the moment.
Okay, that wraps up the second section of our conversation there.
So that's a bit of circular economy. Get things to feed on themselves and to become sustainable instead of choked off. And last little reference we should make while we're at this is that in the notes we'll post something. There is an upcoming opportunity to join the third act and to so this is happening on Tuesday, July 22nd, from 1 to 5 at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in White River Junction.
Oh, wow. That's not too far away from here.
No. So that's so we'll put a reference to that activity in our show notes.
Yeah, and of course, Third Act is the group, the follow-on group that Bill McKibben formed for us grayer parts of the population to make both our feelings and actions heard, but also maybe some of the investments that we may have towards keeping those dollars. I like that discussion. I didn't like the discussion too much, although it was true, about the hyper-capitalism that's going on with these major banks, both globally and the four big banks that Bill McKibben referred to several times, suicide machines. That's an interesting analogy. But being able to invest your dollars locally, and in the case of energy, you know, some of these municipal solar projects that have gotten off the ground, that, like Bill said, the fossil fuels, the oil, et cetera, are coming from, you know, Texas and Saudi Arabia and Russia, while the wind and the sun and the water, at least local water, which is a whole different subject of hydro, are coming from right here, right wherever you are. Wind and sun are available.
I love the idea of all of the branch offices having smokestacks on top of them to show how much carbon is being burned by your investment.
Yeah. And just a little advance, I won't get into it today. I'm reading a book, and I don't necessarily agree with all of it, but it does actually echo a lot of what Bill and Ayanna were talking about, the capitalist system and how it just keeps piling on itself over and over again, and that there have not really been any changes in investment in the fossil fuel, despite however many COP gatherings we've had that go back to the early days of when Bill McKibben wrote the book, The End of Nature. So there will be some references next week to this book, which is called How to Blow Up a Pipeline, and it's written by Andreas Malm. We will discuss that. Apparently, it's been made into a new movie. Henry, we're down to about 8.5 minutes. I have a few items, but maybe you want to point out a couple of other things before I dive into them?
No, let's dive into them. That sounds like good territory.
Okay, well, just looking in the rearview mirror, our guest last week was Chris Gish, who grew up right here just down the road in Sharon and now works for Standing Trees, and he has an op-ed piece. First of all, on the front page of the Herald is confirmation that the Telephone Gap Project, with very minor changes from its initial iteration, has been approved, which seemed, despite all the civil efforts to change it, to modify it, to protect old growth, it looks like most of it has gone through. So he's got a very, I would say fairly emotional op-ed piece. Telephone gap decision serves Trump's agenda, short changes the public good. Now, just go towards the end of it. He says, now with this decision, nearly 900 acres of clear cuts and other even age cuts will happen. More than 800 stand acres of cutting in areas that meet the Forest Service's own regional old growth definition will happen. Destruction of thousands of acres of habitat for the endangered northern long-eared bat, which uses a rare hibernaculum in the project area, 1,800 acres of logging in the 16,000-acre Pittenden inventoried roadless area. Boy, that is a mouthful. In short, this is Chris Gish writing. In short, the Telephone Gap Project plays directly into the agenda Trump and his allies have for public lands. Slash protections for roadless areas, older forests, and endangered species, while needlessly ramping up public lands logging. Despite the Forest Service final decision, I am immensely grateful for the countless advocates who turned this ill-conceived plan into a years-long education and organizing opportunity. Public scrutiny led to the first ever carbon assessment for any national forest logging project. It spotlighted the need for stronger, mature, and old forest protections and how industry bias and outdated priorities hinder the Forest Service from managing our public lands for the greatest public good. I'm going to stop there. There's still a couple paragraphs. You can read the entire piece in today's Herald. There was a story in yesterday's Valley News about, which Chris referred to, as far as some lawsuits that are occurring over in the White Mountain national forest areas in New Hampshire. And there is extensive quoting of the lead attorney that Chris referred to. He didn't say his name, but it is in that story. And Henry, I think we need, and he is an attorney and a professor here at the Vermont Law and Graduate School. So I think that that gentleman may be a future guest here on Green Zine.
All right. let's see. Give me some.
I'll send that to you. Hey, and in kind of more naturalist news and good news, we're big fans of Northern Woodlands magazine, which is a seasonal magazine put out of Lyme, New Hampshire. We've interviewed several writers for it and the former editor. So this week in the woods, so this is in the current summer edition, the second week of July. The folks at Northern Woodlands admired the transverse banded drone fly accumulating Rudbeckia pollen. We've been watching some of the pollinators. We're worried that the pollinator population is going way down, but we, my partner and I have seen a little bit of an uptick, so we're a little bit more optimistic about that. But this drone fly belongs to the family Syrphida, also known as syrphid flies, flower flies for their predictable presence around flowers, and hover flies for their ability to remain stationary in flight. While many hoverflies may resemble bees or wasps because of their yellow and black abdomens and overlap in habitat and also serve as pollinators, they stand out as flies for having two wings rather than four, short antenna, eyes at the front of their heads, and no distinct waist. Joe Rankin in his Outside Story article, and those articles often show up in the Herald. There's one in the Herald today, as a matter of fact. These bee mimics benefit from the reputation of stinging insects without themselves having the ability to sting. In other words, they're imposters. Among the many hoverflies in our area, this species stands out for its yellow scutellum, the shield-shaped structure between the upper parts of its wings. This goes on to talk about the Canada lily, also about the flowering raspberry, and finally in the last paragraph about what happens with killdeer chicks and how they imprint upon their parents. So a lot of great naturalist information in the summer edition of Northern Woodlands.
Yes, and you had a little piece that you were thinking sounded quite bogus, but I've done some research on it as well. And that was on a Chinese company,
Huawei,
now rolling out an EV that just does it all, fills up just like gasoline at a fuel stop, and gets lots of mileage and has all the bells and whistles for the future that makes it so that that EVs are not inconvenient. And there are problems with that, and I might say as an EV owner that if you have home charging, all those issues of how long it takes to refill is really not an issue. All you have to do is just remember to plug it in overnight occasionally when you sort of get down to half a tank or something. And and this EV that the Chinese have will take it on charge very fast, but it requires a charging station that can deliver a really fast charge, and it's technologically pretty fancy rig to make it happen.
Right.
Which is really useful for, you know, someone that does nothing but driving back and forth from the East Coast to the West Coast of the United States, and they're continually having to refuel somewhere on the road.
Yeah.
But for us mere mortals that that only occasionally drive a long distance, home charging can be very slow. I invested in two level two chargers, which, you know, cost more money to install and so forth. And I realized I probably could have done it on a 120-volt extension cord.
Yeah, there you go, Henry.
Never even gone there.
Right. Hey, you know, we'll discuss this article a little bit more and maybe some of the bogus or not really that credible claims that the car company is making. But we're reaching the end of our line here. You have been listening to Green Zine at Royalton Community Radio, WFVR-LP in South Royalton. And we want to thank our generous underwriters, Solaflect, Bale, Royal Trail Works, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solarfest, Wit and Grit, and the Yes We Can Collective. Henry, we've got all kinds of guest possibilities for next week. Always good to hang with you. I'm going to give you the last word as we move into the final 15 seconds before Democracy Now.
Yeah. So I just want to say to you listeners, it's great to have you on board. And by all means, please be in touch with us either.